People usually go to college to learn, but today we're going to learn about college, the Electoral College, that is. This is Lisa Berry, and this is In the Public Interest on 89.1 WEMU, our biweekly conversation with the League of Women Voters of the Ann Arbor area. Our guest today is John Chamberlain, Professor Emeritus of Political Science and Public Policy at the University of Michigan, active in a range of so-called good government groups, and a League member, I trust, John?
Yes.
Of course, the Electoral College is a process, not a place, established in the Constitution, but give us some background and an explanation of how it works.
Well, it was assembled at the Constitutional Convention when the states were forming a nation, and each state was assigned a certain number of electors. And the Electoral College decides who's going to be president by looking at who wins the vote in each state. And in all but two cases, all of a state's electoral votes go to the candidate who wins that state. Maine and Nebraska have slightly different variations on the scene. And whoever gets the most electoral votes is elected president. So it is a fairly routine operation. Most people don't know who the electors are. They know which candidate they're voting for and what the party that is, and that party's electors will get to cast the votes.
We hear a lot of conversation about the pros and cons of the Electoral College. Can you go over some of those for us?
Well, I think the chief pro is we've always done it that way, and, you know, do we really need to make a change? I think that it builds on the federal structure of the national government that was put in place at the Constitutional Convention. It almost always provides a decisive outcome. In only one election did the Electoral College winner get less than 50% of the vote, and that was in 1824. It tends to favor the two-party system, and so people who like the two-party system think we ought to stick with the Electoral College as it exists.
What are some of the cons?
Well, public opinion has for a long time thought we ought to trade it in for something else. It's not a form of direct election. It's mediated by the states. So we're not looking at the national popular vote. We're looking at state popular votes. It has one real Achilles heel. That's the 1824 case. Four candidates got electoral votes. No one got a majority. And when that happens, the election goes among the top three candidates to the House of Representatives, where each state gets one vote. That's got to be about the most undemocratic piece of institutions in the country. Other people would say that it focuses almost all of the attention in campaigns in the seven or eight battleground states where they're fighting neck and neck for the electoral votes. And in a state where it's pretty clear that the Democrats going to win or the Republicans going to win, the campaigns don't show up. There's also a problem with faithless electors. Electors are chosen to cast their votes for one party or another. They're not required to do that. Sometimes they don't. And a recent court case says they're free to cast their vote any way they want. That seems that you ought to be able to fix that up, but it does seem to go against the spirit of that. And the thing that gets us to the controversy is that the Electoral College can miss the national popular vote winner. It's done that five times, starting in 1824. But in 2000, when Gore got more popular votes than George W. Bush, and recently in 2016, when Hillary Clinton got more popular votes than Donald Trump, the Electoral College missed the national popular vote winner. And some people think that's the gold standard for who ought to be elected, is whoever wins the national popular vote. I'm more of a skeptic on that.
Well, enter the popular vote interstate compact. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this one gets a little complicated, but following the 2000 election, some people thought there ought to be a way to change the election structure such that we got the national popular vote winner to win every presidential election. People have tried to amend the Constitution for nearly ever, and mostly in favor of switching from the Electoral College to the national popular vote. There's been over 700 bills introduced in Congress to change the Electoral College. None of them have passed. So a new way to do that is through what, for me, was the most obscure clause in the Constitution, the Compact Clause, which says, with congressional approval, states can form compacts to solve mutual problems. And a lot of these have to do with with boundary problems or their shared waterway problems or parks that cross state boundaries. In this case, the National Popular Vote Compact says what we do is we declare this contract open for states to sign on, and they promise to cast all of their electoral votes for the national popular vote winner, not the state popular vote winner, which is what electors do now. When enough states have signed onto this compact that they have a total of 270 electoral votes, it becomes legally binding. That means that there are states that have at least 270 electoral votes who have promised to vote to cast their electoral ballots for the national popular vote winner. That's enough to win the presidency. It takes, with 538 electoral votes, 270 would do it. This compact has been around now for, I think, close to 15 years. 15 states in the District of Columbia have, joined the compact. Together, they have 195 electoral votes, which means if states having another 75 electoral votes join this compact, it'll take force of law for those states that have compacted or contracted it. It's a form of direct election. They're looking at the national popular vote, not individual state popular votes. It is intended, they say, to get candidates out of just campaigning in battleground states, the 7 or 8 or 9 states where it's really close and there are big electoral votes at stake. And they would campaign more broadly, going where they could get votes. It also is more favorable to minor party candidates and independent candidates, because it means that votes for a Libertarian aren't tallied just in Michigan or North Dakota, but they're added up nationally. That gives them more visibility, might lead to Libertarians casting their vote for the Libertarian candidate rather than for the lesser of the Democrats or Republicans, however they see it. It would change what we do and how we do it. By how much, we won't know until we try it.
How close or far do you think we are from it being enacted?
I think we're quite a ways. I mean, they've gotten close to 200 of the 270 they need, but almost all of that has been in states that were controlled by Democrats. There aren't enough states controlled by Democrats to get another 75 votes, at least currently. One of the states, Colorado, which passed it recently, 4 states have joined since 2016 election, one of which was Colorado. And citizens of Colorado who didn't like that have now gotten permission to have a ballot initiative where they could back out of the compact. Made 4 steps forward and half a step back there. We'll see how that goes. But unless Republicans start getting on this bandwagon, it's going to be hard to get to 270.
That's the Popular Vote Interstate Compact. Also, we've been talking about the Electoral College, and these conversations are intended to be informational for listeners. So if you want to find out the League's position on the matter, you can visit their website. Meanwhile, John Chamberlain, Professor Emeritus of Political Science and Public Policy at the University of Michigan, we thank you for joining us for this edition of In the Public Interest here on 89.1 WEMU.
You're very welcome. Thank you.